I mean, the most notable local organization, the one of longest standing, is Portland Cop Watch, which has been at this for 30 years and tirelessly has documented, all of the various policy changes and political maneuverings of the police during that time. I understand the Democratic Socialists of America have taken an interest in the issue. And the labor movement has had a role in this on and off for decades. I mean, in the 90s, organizations like VOLS and the Workers' Organizing Committee were working with day laborers, and part of that work involved trying to keep the police out of immigration enforcement. In the early aughts, as I mentioned, after the Carpenters Union was hassled by the Joint Terrorism Task Force, there was a major union rejection of the city's participation in that group. As recently as 2020, like, there were labor contingents at the demonstrations after the murder of George Floyd. I remember seeing social workers in my union handing out shields. As for what they should be doing now in terms of the PPA and the Central Labor Council, I mean, urging their representatives on the Central Labor Council to reject this. And I think, again, maintaining the cordon sanitaire that if the police association joins the Central Labor Council, other unions should leave.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Christian Williams, for your contribution to this discussion. And I'm hoping that our union members listening to this show will take note and act accordingly. That wraps it up for tonight's Labor Radio show, this Monday and every Monday at 6 p.m. on KBOO. You've been listening to Christian Williams, member of Ask Me Local 88 and author of Our Enemies in Blue, Peace and Power, Police and Power in America. I'm Jamie Partridge. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Baby, you understand me now.
This is Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. In March 2025, the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission Summit was held in Salem, Oregon. We'll hear excerpts from the summit as Commission Chair Paul Solomon introduces Sterling Cuneo and Christopher Lambert, who served decades in the Oregon prison system. They'll share their experiences while incarcerated, reentry, and finding success in the community.
This panel brings together remarkable individuals who have successfully navigated Oregon's criminal legal system despite significant challenges. They will share their experiences with incarceration, reentry, and finding success in the community. First, we'll hear from Sterling Cuneo. Sterling is an award-winning author, playwright, and poet, an Oregon Literary Arts Fellow, Penn American Arts for Social Justice Fellow, and World Yes Jammer, whose work has been published in the Marshall Project, LA Book Review, and performances by various artists, including Grammy Award-winning musician Antino Sanchez. Sterling now works as a lead consultant on the Ubuntu Climate Initiative, a global climate resilience movement focused on reuniting people and planet through joy, art, and sustainability.
I'm going to give y'all the abbreviated version. You know, my experience with the criminal legal system literally includes every level, from after school detention to push out policies to juvenile detention to foster care to arrest to trial to court of appeals to federal courts to legislation to solitary confinement, maximum security prison, and reentry programs afterwards. So I'm going to try to do it quickly. The first 12 years of my life, I was actually raised in a stable home environment, loving home environment, free of drugs, alcohol, violence of any kind. Same long lifetime, childhood friends, same school, all of that stuff. And then my mom died when I was 12. And after that, I was spent the next 2 years bouncing around a total of 7 times between 4 states before ending up homeless at 14 years old. old, sleeping in newspaper recycle bins just a few blocks from this building. While in the streets, I became adept and familiar with and a participant in the culture of street crime. And my activities started as, you know, vandalism at first, stealing food second, and then just escalated as I became more and more contact with the system, truthfully, you know. At first, my criminal activity, I literally just began as a kid with nothing else to do, so we threw rocks through windows for nighttime entertainment. And that led to police contact, which led to arrest, which led to placement in juvenile homes and or juvenile facilities. And in them juvenile facilities, I began to become exposed to the culture of street crime and start to model and adapt those ethics and those codes and live by that lifestyle, which my behavior only continued to escalate until I committed acts of violence, serious violence, and was sentenced to consecutive life without the possibility of parole sentences at the age of 16 years old, before Oregon law allowed for juvenile lifers. So there was a lot of litigation and court issues around my case, and as it related to me and a set of law that related to four other boys at this time. And when I first got there, this is what, you know, I want to share unequivocally. When I first got to prison, it made me worse. It literally made me worse. Even though I have went to prison for committing the most grave act that one human being could commit against another and taking a life. But when I first got there, I didn't have to account for that, you know. From the time of arrest, they told me right from the gate, anything I said could be and would be used against me. So I just keep my mouth shut. And then when in court, everything about this harm and this offense, it was only looked at in the context of mitigating or aggravating. You know, defense attorneys did their best to try to save me from a system, and they just made arguments about mitigation. Prosecutors, they trying to prosecute the case, so they making arguments about aggravation. And nowhere, at no time, was I encouraged to really think about the human impacts that I had, and I couldn't have did it at that stage. I was traumatic, I was violent, I was sick with ideas of what it meant to be a man, as a boy, you know. And then when I got to prison, in the prison culture, you don't have to talk about your crime. When you first get there, you get a paperwork check. For that means if you haven't prosecuted, you haven't participated in a prosecution, you ain't told on nobody, you ain't snitched on nobody, you ain't took the stand on nobody, you ain't committed any sexual offenses or offenses that involve children, you're good, right? According to the prison culture. And you never have to talk about your crime again. Staff, counselors, officers, they're told don't go there. So I never had to account for the human impacts that I had. And then I spent 9.5 years in solitary confinement, and that just compounded all of the issues. And it was there, for the sake of my sanity, that I decided to start writing, because it was in an environment to where the only socially acceptable emotions expressed was anger and frustration. And in my mid-20s, I had started to feel regret, remorse, vulnerability, loss, confusion, and I was in an environment that I couldn't process that. So I started writing, and then, you know, won a bunch of awards, which got me a different platform, which helped raise me and elevate my story to gaining community support and other opportunities that eventually led to my commutation by former Governor Kate Brown. And when I came home, I immediately went to work with Church at the Park, which is a faith-based organization here in Salem, Oregon, building tiny home communities for the houseless. And I began to go to work for Regroup, which is a support and empowerment network of formerly incarcerated people. And as of January 1st of this year, which is when I stepped down, but as of then, over 3 years, we had zero recidivism amongst our participants. And as far as I know, we were the only organization whose membership was open across the whole state to everybody, not restricted by county or program participation. And we did it by centering thriving, by focusing on thriving. In my work with Free Group, I got to go, you know, Vital Social Projects, Waverly Foundation, Sunshines. I got to go all across the nation looking at other reentry programs and what people were doing and what they were doing well. And, you know, everywhere I went, it was clear that people understood that employment and housing was huge issues. And what we did at Regroup, we started asking, like, we understand that the basics to surviving in a successful reentry is employment and housing. But why are we defining our mere survival as the goal or as the success when we have the capacity to thrive, right? And we relied primarily on a peer-to-peer model and a mutual aid model because we prided ourselves on being a group of credible messengers, and all of the grants required system partners, and half of our community wasn't cool with that idea. So we knew right from the gate we was gonna have to try to figure out how to support each other. And so we started showing up, we started picking up each other, we started calling each other, we started talking to each other, we were sharing resources, creating information, and continuing the work that we had actually started inside. And through that work, one of the projects that we took on and contributed to, led really, was ballot measure 112, which removed the authorization of slavery from the Oregon Constitution. That was a lot of effort that a lot of people in here helped with too. And out of that effort, I got the opportunity to go work for the Ubuntu Climate Initiative, which took me all around the country and other parts of the world, looking at the intersections of art and healing. And I was being focused on in reentry to, that's where my interest is now, is because whereas we talk a lot about the employment and the house, so many of us know that, what I think we need to also start talking about is the necessity of healing and being in recovery from carceral impacts. And I think nature has a role in that. And we're also missing an opportunity to develop leadership from those that are coming home, from those that have committed their life to becoming better people and went through them personal transformation processes and educated ourselves. I got all the degrees and the certificates and all that stuff, read all the Goschalk books, know all the evidence, data, participated in the work committees on legislation. Not just the academic, but the lived experience, having went through it and done it. Once we learn how to leverage that experience and empower that leadership and enable that healing, we're going to be able to figure out how to change this recidivism rate that actually hasn't changed too much in the last 30 years. So I think in reentry, and particularly credible messengers that have done the work in that field, has the solution to shifting the paradigm in Oregon.
We will next hear from Christopher Lambert. After over two decades behind bars, Christopher turned his pain into purpose. Now the regional service director of Rose City Jam at the Oregon Justice Network, he is dedicated to breaking cycles, creating opportunities, and inspiring others to rise above their past.
My name is Christopher Lambert. I'm from North Portland. My story is kind of similar to any other young black man growing up in Northeast or North Portland. I come from a family of love. Although my father was never there, I say I was raised in a two-parent home because my mother and my grandmother raised me. Everything was smooth as growing up, just doing the regular things, playing sports, hanging out with friends. You know, the small criminal activity that we did, we stole bottles and chromies off of wheels, just the childish things. As I was in North Portland, my grandmother stayed in Northeast Portland. My grandmother was involved in a horrible domestic violence situation where she was ran over by a truck and dragged a block away. When that happened, that's when I first encountered anger. I wanted to do some damage to the individual that did that to my grandmother. Of course, I didn't know how to deal with that anger. I walked around in my neighborhood with a bat. I was a part of a program called Gang Peace. I had a mentor, David Jackson, DJ OG1. Who actually spoke to me and really gave me the scope of, okay, if I do this, if I do violence to who harmed my grandmother, that does nothing for my grandmother. And if I did violence, then of course I end up in prison. When that happened, my grandmother's house was big and she was in the hospital for about 2 years. And as she was in the hospital, we remodeled her house in order for it to be wheelchair accessible. So when I moved from I went from North Portland going to Northeast Portland, where the activity is just active and live. Once I moved to Northeast Portland, my mother began to take care of my grandmother. The relationship with me and my mother kind of deteriorated. I wouldn't say deteriorated, but the energy went all to take care of my grandmother. So there was a sense of a lack of love there. I eventually just found myself in the streets. I started selling drugs. I got real deep in the drug game. And unfortunately, like, the area I was selling drugs in was kind of somebody area. So, you know, I moved different areas, and then with that came the gang life, end up falling into the gang life. And with that came guns. One day I was selling drugs on a corner, and I wasn't supposed to be over there, and I knew I wasn't supposed to be over there. However, a situation took place and I was threatened, and I moved and went to my neighborhood, told my friends, got them all riled up, and nothing happened. I happened to be out one night going to a concert, and I ran into that same individual. And in the matter of us arguing, to me leaving, to me being followed, in a matter of 20 seconds, I let my gun go off 8 shots, and I ended up injuring 3 individuals. With that mentality, I was moving off of street mentality. And that street mentality is kill or be killed. I didn't want to die, so most definitely moving off that mentality, I was activated in that way and moving with a gun for the sake of my life. That shooting took place. 2 weeks later, I was arrested. In the midst of that taking place, there's no social media, anything like that. I didn't know if anybody had died. I didn't know if anybody got shot. I didn't know nothing. I was so deep in the streets that I just went on normally about my life and tried to avoid the police to my best extent. I ended up going to a party. I ended up getting shot at, and the police happened to be canvassing the scene. And obviously the police knew me, and I went to jail for a DUI warrant. Once I go to jail for a DUI warrant, they opened my cell and let me know that they was charging me with 4 counts of attempted aggravated murder, 4 counts of assault, and 8 counts of unlawful use of a weapon. Still didn't know the severity of my, like, what was going on, the severity of that. It took about 2 days in order for me to process that. I was charged with some serious things. As I was going through that process, I was in the county jail, and there's nothing for me to do in order to, like, pour into myself. So I just adapted to the street mentality again, which is, you know, gang banging in county jail to selling drugs to nothing. It came a point where I just wanted to be out the cell, so I decided to get in high school classes, GED classes, because that was the only way for me to get out my cell was 23-1. My counselor ended up taking a real liking to me and really pouring into me, and I ended up passing about 4 tests before I was sentenced to 20 years in prison. The street life had me so numb to reality that when I got sentenced to 20 years in prison, it didn't faze me at all, to the point where like this come with the life that we live. It didn't hit me until I talked to my grandmother and I told her how much time I got. And she asked me how much time I got. And although I only got 20 years, I said, "Grandma, that gave me life." Cause that's what it felt like. It was the words from my grandma that kept me going. And those words was, "You got a pill, don't you?" And I said, "Yeah." So we pushed all the way. And those words right there, like, gave me the strength to move forward. Once I was sentenced to prison, I was sent to Eastern Oregon, far away from my family, 3 hours away from my family. And I think that's one of the problems that come to sentencing. People happen to get all this time and they get sent far away from their family. The family is a needed structure as a person is going through incarceration. If it wasn't for my family and my friends, I wouldn't have the urge to want to do better. I always say that the amount of support I had while I was in prison, because I had a ton of support, the amount of support I had in prison, I can't pay nobody back no amount of money on what they did for me. The only thing I can do is come home and be a better person and be great and keep my mother proud. When my first 5-10 years in prison, I sold drugs to provide for myself, involved in little petty DRs for having somebody else's CD. Like, ended up in a hole for extra pair of drawers, just, you know, the pettiness that really interrupted how I was doing my time. It was during the time that I was involved in a 175-man riot that I was in the hole for 6 months. There's nothing to do in the hole but read and write. And I had to sit with myself and ask myself, what did I want different for myself? I started to read books. I started to distance myself from certain crowds. When I got out the hole, I ended up getting a job, interviewing for a job, and got a job at the DMV call center at OSCI. To leave Eastern Oregon after doing 10 years, I actually felt like I was being paroled to get up out of there to go to another prison. One thing that changed me is when I was in OSCI, I had a group of individuals, they had life, and they was really invested in me and got me involved in the Inside Out classes through University of Oregon. Those classes provided me with a sense of leadership and a sense of confidence. I got clemency by the former Governor Kay Brown, and since I've been home, I've been working knee-deep in my community. I've created a safe place for kids to come. We've had over 180 kids at each event in Portland, Oregon at the Blazers Boys and Girls Club. And as far as reentry and the things that helped me, no system was in place to help me. It was my community. It was my friends. When I first got home, I was able to get a job at my friend's restaurant called Trap Kitchen. That right there provided me with the resources to take care of myself and really get into the work. And by the grace of God, my friend Sean appointed me the regional service director at Rose City Jam. And since we've been going, we've been having a huge impact in my community, and I see it every day. And it's on me and my friends that we're working with the youth to curb that violence, but we also hope that we inspire those that come from the same life so they want to do the same thing.
What were challenges that you faced when getting out of the jail setting, like in regard to any of the community resources that you needed, for example, the Oregon Health Plan?
Like I said, when I came out, I really didn't have any resources. I leaned on my community. My community was there, but I also had the mind frame that, you know, if I was working in prison, getting $30 a month, that I was for sure going to work somewhere for $17 an hour. With that determination, I was open to do anything. At this time, I'm employed as an intensive case manager, working with all the high-risk gang members in Portland, Oregon, and I'm helping them transition out of that life at their own will, but just being a support system there. So, like, leaning on my community was the huge, it was the only help that I really had.
I was very fortunate in the amount of support and opportunity that I came out to. I didn't experience any challenges in terms of housing or employment. I got off to a really good start. My challenges came probably, I say, about 6 or 7 months out when I started to realize that I was still in a hypervigilant state, that I'd be, you know, in the Cheesecake Factory, trying to figure out why this fucking waiter keep walking by me 3 or 4 times, you know what I mean? And I would go, I remember I went to a training, I came out and I immediately went to work for Lewis and Clark of Willamette University, and I remember the very first training I went to, we were sitting around the table like this. Somebody asked me a question, like, hey, where are you from? We was out at Hood River. I was like, oh, I'm over here from Salem. It's like, where are you with? And I'm like, you know, regroup, transformative justice community. It's like, yeah, and I'm like, what's up with all these questions? Right? And it took me a minute to realize, yo, this is normal social dynamic, right? And then the other thing, you know, I started to realize that it had been so long since I had cried. And, you know, and when I was sitting there at a waterfall during the sunset, looking at all these different beautiful colors and finally feeling like this sense of peace and tranquility, I started crying, you know, and it was like, and when I say cry, I wasn't bawling, it was a couple, you know, y'all don't tell nobody, this is between me and all of us, right? But I was like, what the fuck is this? Like, I done came through all of this and I'm gonna lose my mind by a waterfall and just start crying for no reason. And so I really started, you know, started thinking about what that meant. And what that was is it was okay. I was finally okay, like starting to let my guard down. I had thought that because I had learned how to dance in my armor that I was okay. And I didn't even realize how heavy of a burden it was. You know, I would frequently be celebrated for my ability to keep my head up through all things and continuously be resilient. It doesn't matter. Peel after peel, effort after effort, denied, you just keep going. And, you know, and I knew very well that I had the ability not to be impacted by negative emotions, but now I was struggling to connect with my positive emotions. I had been able to shut off so much that it was like, how do I reconnect? You know, and that popped up in interpersonal relationships, that popped up with a sense of guilt. All of my friends and family that was mostly lifers are still behind the bars, and here I am. I got to do the greatest, not just for me, but for all of them. And, you know, I found myself struggling with what am I supposed to do now that I've achieved everything that I wanted. And there wasn't a lot of conversations like that. They'd be like, you got three jobs, you working too much, and, you know, so on and so forth. So for me, the biggest challenge was, you know, not the necessities that you come out right out the gate with. And in our work with Regroup, what we noticed, a lot of us came home at a unique time in history between the Ramos decisions, between the unprecedented use of commutation power, the COVID, the firefighters. We had a lot of our peer groups come home simultaneously. So we almost had like this unintended social experiment where I know damn near most of these people, right? Literally just mobilizing them people was how we was able to run a campaign. And what we started realizing, like, it just in that case sample, I'm not the academic, I ain't studying all that stuff, but in all the people I know, and then I'm talking about specifically, none of us struggled right out the gate, right? We were inside working on release plans and dissolving toxic masculinity. We were collaborating with Inside Out programs in Willamette. We came out with an idea that we wanted to do good, and we didn't get discouraged by employment challenges or anything like that. And what we started seeing that it was actually about a year to 18 months when people would start to have a destabilizing thing, whether it was a breakup, a loss of a job, got laid off, and they done took on all these bills, reoccurring bills. And that's when they would start struggling with, you know, the emotional and the mental aspect of having to transition into a new life. So
the next question is, do you feel like prison saved your life? And if not, where do you think you would be today if there was no intervention?
I most definitely feel like prison saved not only my life, but possibly somebody else's life. I take it as me going to prison was a comma from God, where I really had to sit with myself and actually let my guard down and receive all the love and the genuine care that people have for me. Going to restorative justice, taking accountability for my actions, going to Inside Out classes. I think having people believe in me and pouring to me was the intervention that I needed. So I most definitely think prison did save me, and the interventions that came from programs within the prison most definitely were the intervention for me to want to do better. But it's also, I seen the pain that my mother went through when I went to prison. Although I got sentenced to 20 years, my family had to do that 20 years with me. Mm-hmm. I felt bad for that. And seeing the hurt on my mom's face, I didn't want that to be my life. But I don't want that to be nobody else's life. And that's why, you know, when we, you know, with Oregon Justice Network and Rose City Gym, when we talking to the kids, we bring up the mother aspect, because I don't care how hard you is, your mom is your soft spot. And I bring that up, I'd be like, you know, my mom cried. I don't want to see your mom go through the same thing my mom had to go through. And that's the way we connect with them and really gain their trust and pour into them and be a supportive system for them.
Yeah, and I'll just say, having worked with thousands of people over the years coming back to the community, that the longer people stay in prison, the more likely they are to become institutionalized and have a more difficult time reentering the community. And I've seen a lot of people who, after 10, 15, 20 years, just couldn't handle it. And so it always strikes me that people like Chris and people like Sterling, who've done significant amounts of time, have been able to hold on to that sense of self, that dignity, and do the internal work despite all of the dysfunction that occurs in prisons, all of the drama, because it's easy to get caught up in it. And it's much more difficult to push against that and then get out and address all of the myriad barriers that people experience.
I got a little slightly different view. I'm able to celebrate my life despite my prison experience. And I unequivocally attribute my personal transformation to love and education, particularly, you know, the form of support, people that was never gave up on my humanity, you know. And I can take it in terms of systems analysis, you know, I can take it back to being a 12-year-old kid who just lost his mom and was uprooted from his home and sent to a little country bumpkin school in Arkansas and get sent to detention for emotional outburst. And then I'm understanding, I can look back and I can see how, you know, I received probation at times I might have should have received therapy. I look back at the environments that I was placed in as a child suffering that actually exacerbated that, particularly these, I was placed in group homes. Two of the five group homes that I was placed in eventually ended up getting shut down by the state for abusing children and the abuses that would happen in them places. School, I got in trouble in school and they suspended, you know, they kicked me out and my outburst. And as a kid, I was actually quiet. To this day, I'm actually an introvert. People don't believe that, but I was actually quiet. And then after the death of my mom, I started having these emotional outbursts that got treated as a behavioral issue that got punished. So I was punished all the way. I was punished with double life without triple 23. Like, they didn't help. The system didn't help. And then when I refused to let my spirit be broken, they threw me in solitary confinement. The people that invested in me was volunteers. The programs that helped me the most, that gave me, you know, education was so important because with new information, I could have new ideas. And with new ideas, I could reimagine what was possible for me in the world. So whereas I might have once idolized Al Capone, I was now looking at Nelson Mandela and Martin Luther King and Gandhi and Viktor Frankl. And that all came through education. And these put me in the hole for having books that weren't mine. Right? And I'm the outlier. Just because I come home and I'm working on my emotional growth and my spiritual well-being and giving back, you know, I had to fight for the opportunities that I got. And the people that invested in me and helped in me, they are often barred or discouraged. And so I have seen the system. You know, I did 28 years inside, so I've seen different administrations and different cultural environments and stuff, different atmospheres. And I came home a little over 3 years ago, and when I was leaving, there was starting to be a shift. But for the most part, it was